So tonight, for a few minutes, I wanted to talk about, if you will, the imperfection of the saints. I know this morning we had mentioned, at least in coming to the close of our lesson, that we are saints as Christians. I know there are those who consider the word saint, and in their mind, it's an elevated saint. It's somebody who's really, really trying to get to heaven, much more than just normal sort of trying. But the word that is used by Paul is used in Colossians 3:12, that we are holy and beloved. So we are holy and loved. And it's the same word he uses all through chapter 1, saints. So we are saints, but, and I don't know how else to put it, I think we are in some ways putting too much of a burden on ourselves to the degree that we think we've really got to just be perfect. And we know we can't. It's this contradiction of trying and yet knowing that we cannot do that. So what I want to do tonight, spend a little bit of time as we look at, I guess, what we would call God's Hall of Faith. I've heard it as the Hall of Fame, Hall of Faith. But in Hebrews chapter 11, let's go through and look at the characters that God portrays to us as examples. And we're not going to look at every single person in this, but we can hit the highlights, I think, pretty easily. And one of the things I'll suggest to you is that as we look at God's Hall of Faith, it is filled with sinners. There's nobody perfect in this, unless you want to look at maybe somebody like Enoch or Abel, maybe those two guys who are the first two examples that are used. But Hebrews 11, verse 4, by faith Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts. And through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not experience death, and he was not found because God had taken him. Now, before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God, and without faith, it is impossible to please God. For whoever would draw near to him must believe that he exists, and that he rewards those who seek him. So maybe the first couple examples, we don't know of anything in the life of Abel or Enoch that we can say, aha, look, there is this sin that they did, and we know they weren't perfect. I would suggest, just by the estimation of the rest of what we find in the Bible, like Romans 3:23, that all have sinned and fall short of glory of God, there may have been something in their lives, we just don't know. But when we get to verse 8, and we're talking about Abraham, or verse 7, I didn't mean to skip Noah, but with Noah and Abraham both, we know their, things that they did sinful. We've got Noah who got drunk. We've got Abraham who lied out of convenience. And he did so a couple times. You remember just getting himself out of some trouble, he thought, with Abimelech. He was like, this is my sister. You, my wife, tell him you're my sister. And she does. And it was a technical sort of yes, true, but not really, you know. And Abimelech, of course, kind of freaks out when he finds out this is another man's wife. And the same thing with the Pharaoh, a king who took her because she was a beautiful woman, and come to find out, God forewarns him, this is somebody else's wife. So, but Abraham did that. Abraham had a family of liars, basically. You can go through the whole genealogy of Abraham. That's kind of what they learned as we talk about Jacob. I mean, how did Jacob get his promise from Esau? Well, Esau sold it for, you know, a meal, his birthright. But you remember when Jacob actually went in to get it, he and his own mom, which was, you know, the wife, came in and lied. Basically, he put on a hairy, woolly sort of thing to portray himself as Esau, knowing it wasn't Esau. And it's funny because Isaac's like, you smell like Esau, but you don't sound like Esau. Come here, let me touch you. And touches all over him because he was a blind man. So Jacob was a liar. Sarah, you know, she didn't have the complete faith, as you look at her in verse 11 as an example. And you can go through Moses in verse 23. We know about him as a murderer. He got really angry as he saw injustice. And he didn't just start some campaign. He killed the guy who was going against a Hebrew. You can go through with Israel in verse 29. We know everything about them. Rahab, to this day, we call her, as the Bible calls her every time it mentions Rahab, even in the genealogy of Jesus, She has called Rahab the harlot. We talk about things that we can't shake ourselves today, we can't get away from. Again, forever, she seems to be known as Rahab the harlot, or Rahab the prostitute, as if one word makes it a little bit better than the other. And you go through, in verse 32, what more shall I say, the writer is saying? Time would fail me to talk about Gideon. Gideon had trust issues with God. Barak, Samson. To be honest with you, out of all the Bible characters, Samson is one of the most confusing to me. Because Samson is a very worldly person. He basically is one of those guys who finds out what the rules are, and he gets either as close to breaking them as he can, or just breaks them and figures, you know what, I'll be an exception. He marries outside of the faith, and he should not have. He does so many bad things, and even in his death there is infamy. He commits suicide in his death. But again, God lists him here as a man of faith. Jephthah. You can just take it at face value. He may have very well had his own daughter killed because he said, the first thing that comes out of my house, I will sacrifice to the Lord. And I know there's a lot of ways we try to get around that, but I don't know. Just looking at the bare facts of the Bible, it very well may be that's what he did. David. We speak so highly of David, and yet, what is the one story we all know about David? Bathsheba. I mean, we talk about David and Goliath, and it's like, yeah, but that's the same David who sees a pretty woman and finds out it's somebody else's wife, and he's like, I don't care. She's going to be mine. And he goes so far as to arrange the execution, or the assassination, or whatever you want to call it, of the man she was married to, just so he could have her himself. David is a confusing character for how good he was and how bad he was at times. David was a bad father, by the way. When we talk about Absalom, if you don't know the story, there's the story of Absalom's sister, who he tries desperately to protect from his half-brother, who rapes his sister. And David does nothing. David does zero. He tries to do nothing. He doesn't fix it. He doesn't talk to the son who's the rapist. He doesn't do anything. He ignores the whole thing. And Absalom gets extremely angry and waits for years before exacting revenge. And I'm not trying to excuse Absalom. I'm just saying that David kind of created his own problem there with his son. But with all these people, even Samuel, Samuel's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were horrible people. I mean, the Bible actually tells us they were bad. Samuel, the great Samuel. So as we go through this, and we don't know everything about everybody else that is mentioned from verse 33 on. Daniel, we don't really know anything bad about him if he's referenced. And I would expect him to be the reference in verse 33. You can talk about those who quench the power of fire, maybe Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We don't know so much about them. But there are so many others. If they were people, even having faith in God meant at some point they failed God. They sinned. And in sinning, they were to be held accountable by God. When you go through the Bible in the New Testament even, you think of somebody like Peter. Peter's this great Bible character, and I guess the question might be, where do we even begin with Peter? I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why most people, if we try to kind of in our minds associate with anyone in the New Testament, I think most of us want to be like Peter. I don't think we're anywhere close to Peter. Peter, I think, is a born leader. I've mentioned this a number of times to y'all that, you know, like in John 21, when he says, I'm going fishing, everybody seems to just join him. There's no debate. He was that sort of personality. When he wanted to do something, people just, they followed. I'm the sort of guy, I mean, honestly, it's just the way it is. If I tell people I'm going to go back to work, they're like, all right, see ya. Peter wasn't that way. He was a born leader. He's always listed first when the apostles are listed. I even think about him as walking on water. That fits the personality of Peter. If it's you, Lord, command me to walk on water. And Jesus says, it's me. Come on out. You know, and it's not like Peter goes, oh, I didn't really mean for him to do that. He just seems to go on, you know. That's Peter. But even so, we know a lot about Peter, and a lot of what we know is an impetuous sort of person. That fits the leadership personality. But like in Galatians 2, I don't know what this fits. This doesn't fit anything. Look over in Galatians 2, verse 11 through 14. Because what we read here is that Paul had to confront Peter to his face because of his duplicity, his hypocrisy. You know, Peter, he is the apostle who was given the keys to the kingdom of heaven. And he's told in Matthew 16, whatever you bind shall have been bound, whatever you loose will have been loosed. All the apostles are told that in Matthew 18, so it's not exclusive to Peter forever, but it is in Matthew 16, exclusive to Peter. Later, all the apostles are told the same exact thing. And so Peter preaches the gospel in its fullness to the Jews. He's the first one ever to do that in Acts 2. In Acts 10, he's the first one to preach the gospel in fullness to the Gentiles. That's his privilege. So you'd think he would understand things, but he seems not to. Verse 11, when Cephas, which is the Aramaic name for Peter, when he came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face, Paul says, because he stood condemned. Now, Paul is not saying this to the Galatians like, oh, you love Peter. I'll tell you about Peter. It's nothing like that. It's because he is addressing, that is, Paul is addressing this whole thing about the law of Moses. The law doesn't save anybody. And he gives this as an example. As he says in verse 12, before certain men came from James, Peter was eating with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. He feared them, which, I don't know about you, this is kind of a surprise. Peter feared anybody, really? Well, that's what Paul says. He feared the circumcision party. And the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, which means they followed his lead, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that their behavior was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas in front of them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? Paul says, I confronted him to his face. Now, I think part of the reason he had to do that is because this is what Paul tells Timothy about elders. Peter more than likely was an elder at this time, not necessarily, but he was a leader. Leaders are, I know we talk about this, we don't really like this, the idea of a double standard. But notice what Paul says to Timothy, 1 Timothy 5, 19-20, don't admit a charge against an elder except on the evidence of two or three witnesses. And then he says in verse 20, as for those who persist in sin, rebuke them in the presence of all. He doesn't say rebuke these elders privately. I've only heard of it happening once. I'm not saying that's the only time it's ever happened, but in my own experience, it's been once. And there was much debate over, do we do this privately? Matthew 18, you know, if your brother sins against you, take him aside. But it was an elder. And this is the passage I kept going to, and I said, you just work your way around it. And they're like, no, we really need to do this, because Paul says, rebuking them in the presence of all so that the rest may stand in fear. I mean, the point is you make an example out of him. That may not sound fair, but that's what Paul says to Timothy about an elder. And I'm not saying that's Paul's argument in Galatians 2, but if an elder, then an apostle, for sure. So in my own thinking, I think Paul was obligated to do this to Peter in this way. He had to rebuke him. But Peter wasn't a perfect person. You know, Peter doesn't defend himself, and I think the good thing with Peter is he does repent. Paul doesn't say, I kept urging him to repent and never would. He doesn't say that. It seems a point of not emphasizing the outcome because the outcome was a good outcome. I know you may say, well, that's kind of filling the blanks. Technically, yes. But I can't see Paul saying, I confronted him to his face, he never repented, and so I just let it go. I don't see Paul being that kind of personality, and I don't see Peter being the kind of person who confronted would continue in it. I see him repenting. I remember Peter and Simon the sorcerer in Acts 8, when Simon the sorcerer wanted to buy the ability that Peter and John had to lay their hands on others to give the Holy Spirit in miraculous ways. And he said, your money perish with you. You need to pray to God for forgiveness. And Simon the sorcerer basically says, you pray for me. Peter doesn't go, nope, not doing it. You know, it's nothing like that. So I don't see Peter being that way. But Peter, long story short, not perfect. And we know it. In Proverbs 18:13, thinking about some of these things that kind of fit into what we may and may not know, the writer says, if one gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame. You need to know both sides of the story. And Paul seems to, and that's why he confronts Peter about this. He knows this isn't supposed to be. So as we think about these kinds of things, we need to start with ourselves and expect and demand perfection from others, maybe while letting ourselves slide. You know, what we do is we give ourselves that big break, you know. We shouldn't do that. I know we shouldn't do that. You know we shouldn't do that. Paul speaks about these kinds of things in 1 Corinthians 13, if you look there, about characteristics of what love is. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4. Now, I know in this context he's talking about higher values. Like at the end of chapter 12, he wants to show the Corinthians that they're foolish in arguing over things like, you know, what's the most important of all the gifts. You know, they had the paradigm upside down. They thought the most important spiritual gift was speaking in tongues, and Paul says, actually, that's on the bottom of the list. And so, like he says in verse 29, is everyone an apostle, or all prophets, or all teachers? Does everyone work miracles? You know, and he goes on through that. And I will show you a more excellent way. So, as he speaks about speaking in tongues of men and angels, and if he doesn't have any love, he's just a noisemaker. Is a noisy gong or clanging cymbal. If I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains' faith, but I do not have love, then I am nothing. If I give away everything I have and deliver up my body to be burned, but I do not have love, then I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love doesn't envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing. It rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. And so whatever standards we're going to be looking at, we need to look at the highest standard. We need to start with ourselves. You know, as far as what we expect from others, we should start with ourselves. If we expect to receive love and forgiveness, God says we should give it. That's basically Matthew 18:35. Jesus gives us the warning, if we don't forgive, God's not going to forgive us. James 2:13, mercy, or rather judgment without mercy. If we're that way, then we're not going to receive mercy ourselves. So, you know, it's easy to see that others struggle with things. Sometimes it's harder to see that we do ourselves. And so when it comes to judging. I know we're in a society that's like so afraid of it, but then again, not really. Isn't that ironic? We tolerate everything, but then we don't tolerate everything. You know, we essentially tolerate what we want to tolerate, things that we're comfortable with. So in Matthew 7, and this is the passage that most people who don't even know the Bible, they know Matthew 7, verse 1. And they may not know where it is. They don't have to know where it is to know Bible. You don't have to have that. That's not a requirement. Like knowing John 3:16, you might not know it's John 3:16. Someone may just know that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. That's enough. That's good. But, you know, Matthew 7:1 is in a context. I know a lot of people just don't want context, but context is important. You don't grab anybody's statement out of context. What was he talking about when he said this? Well, it's the Sermon on the Mount. He's been talking about anxiety, worrying, and he then says, judge not that you be not judged. For, and there's that connecting idea. It connects what he's saying with what he's getting ready to say. For, with the judgment you pronounce, you'll be judged. And with the measure you use, it'll be measured to you. That's Jesus' point. It's not just don't judge at all. It's you need to be careful the standard you're using. Why are you seeing the speck in your brother's eye, but you don't notice the log in your own? That's kind of funny, you know? Guy walking around with a 2x4. If we saw anybody like that, I think all of us would kind of freak out, right? A man with a 2x4 sticking out of his head, we're like, whoa, how did that happen? And does it hurt, you know, and all this kind of thing. Wow. But we're more concerned if we're the law guy with the speck. You know, you're blinking really weird. You know somebody's like rubbing their eye. Hey, let me help you here. It's a kind of funny story. How can you say to your brother, Let me take the speck out of your eye when there's that log in your own eye. You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and you'll see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. And then he says about discernment, verse 6, don't give dogs what is holy. And don't throw your pearls before swine or pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn and attack you. I think that's interesting. Jesus doesn't just say, don't throw your pearl before swine because they're going to trample them, but they may turn and then attack you. Jesus, I think, certainly would have that as a experience, no doubt at all. It's like Jesus says in John 7, 23, 24, a different context, but the point is, as they're arguing with him about what to do on the Sabbath, what not to do, Jesus says, if on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision, so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a whole body whole, a man's whole body whole? Don't judge by appearances. Judge with right judgment, which means sometimes our judgment isn't right because we're using some other standard. We're using maybe our own standard. And I know we all do this, and we shouldn't all do that. In James chapter 4, verse 11 through 12, I think it's interesting as James writes, do not speak evil against one another, brothers. The one who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you're not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is only one lawgiver and judge, he who can save and destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor? It's kind of the point, if I were putting this in my own words, there's only one lawgiver. That position is occupied. That seat is taken. Can you imagine going to court and everyone's like, all rise, because here comes the judge. And you see somebody run up and beat the judge into the chair. He sits down. He goes, finders keepers. Nobody does that. That seat is an occupied seat, even when it's unoccupied. That seat's occupied. Well, sometimes we kind of enjoy the idea of being a judge. If we feel strongly in judging others, again, like Jesus said in Matthew 7, we need to start with ourselves. Not always easy. Even in a lesson like this, I know what we're thinking. We're thinking, oh yeah, so-and-so needs this one. No, the point is, you need this lesson. Every single one of us does. I mean, it's easy for us to go, oh, I know somebody who really needs this. Well, if you look in a mirror, then you found somebody pretty easily that needs that lesson. It's, again, the imperfection of the saints. We're not perfect. And sometimes we're too busy looking at everybody else's imperfections to figure that, or forget maybe, that we just don't have them ourselves. I mean, how does that work? We do. So as I urge in Matthew 7, 3 through 5, we need to begin with a man in the mirror, or begin with a person in the mirror. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but don't notice the log that is in your own eye? Notice how he asked that. Why do you not see the speck? Why do you not see the speck, but not notice, you know, the log that is in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye when there's this log in your own eye? Again, Jesus says, you hypocrite. First take out the log of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Now, this is the sort of lesson I could talk probably long and hard about all kinds of other examples, but the point is, at least I hope we get the point, nobody's perfect. We're not perfect. That doesn't mean we just throw our arms up and go, you know what, I quit. I'm not even going to try. It's the point that we need to be compassionate. I really think that's kind of the point. I don't have the slide in all this, but if you look over in Colossians 3, starting in verse 12, and this is a passage we referenced this morning even. But as Christians, you know, it's not our position to be judging. That doesn't mean we make no judgment. Again, John 7, 24, judge righteous judgment. That means we start with what is right and make judgment. And I know some people are going to argue with us because they don't like what we're saying. But it's easy to say, look, this is what the Bible is teaching, or this is what Jesus said. I've had people argue with me, sometimes pretty hard, that you said this. Yes, I did, because I was reading, you know, out of this passage or something. It's not me. It's what was there. You read it too. But notice, and I think it's something we need, especially nowadays. Like Paul would say in Ephesians 4, 11 through 15, verse 15 specifically, speak the truth in love. It's not just speak the truth, but speaks the truth in love. That doesn't mean everything's soft and easy. Sometimes truth has to kind of get in your face, you know. But still, there needs to be a balance in some of this. Put on then, Colossians 3, verse 12. Put on then as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts. I think sometimes that's a struggle. We live in a world that doesn't seem to show a lot of compassion. But as Christians, we need to show compassion. Jesus showed compassion. You might recall the story in the book of Mark, chapter 3, where, interestingly enough, on the Sabbath, he healed a man who had a withered hand, which meant the hand was useless. A man probably with that couldn't work, you know? And if you can't work, it's not like you're on a salary. You either begged or you just had other people help you. But Jesus heals the man. Everybody's so critical. And Jesus is angry with them because they had no compassion on this guy. None. So we need compassion. We need, as Paul says, kindness, humility, meekness. Meekness doesn't mean you're weak. Meekness is the idea that you have strength, but you know how to do things in a way. It's like if you're super strong, you know, a weightlifter dude, and you can lift or bench press, let's say, 700 pounds. You don't walk up to a very delicate china set and just throw it as hard as you can up into the ceiling and break it, because you can't. You know, I'm that strong. Meekness means I'm tempered. I'm able to very delicately deal with something that needs that delicate touch. And at the same time, I'm strong. Meekness is actually strength under control. That's exactly what that word means. The Greeks had a word, proutis, which is the word here. And it means a horse that has been tamed. That's literally, I mean, if you're going to look at the word literally, that's what it is, a horse that's been tamed. That's meekness, strength under control, and patience, bearing with one another. If you've ever seen a little kid and they're trying to do something that looks like impossible, they're trying to get up in a chair that's a little too high, we don't just stand there behind them and laugh, deride them, or tell them what dummies they are because they can't get up in that chair. Most of us, I think, would go, here, let me help you, right? I think that's what Paul's saying, bearing with one another. And if one has a complaint another, forgiving each other, as the Lord has forgiven you. Notice that's the condition. It's not just forgiving, it's forgiving as the Lord has forgiven. So you also must forgive. And above all these, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body. And be thankful. I think it's a balance, and it's a tough thing. I don't know why I closed my Bible, because I want us to go one other chapter over. Look over in Colossians 4. We are in Colossians 3. If you did not do what I just did, you just turn a page over probably, or maybe it's on the same opening. Colossians 4, if you start there, verse 5 and 6, when he says, walk in wisdom toward outsiders, which means we have to make discerning choices when we're interacting with outsiders, outsiders being those outside the fellowship of the blood of Christ. Those who aren't Christians. Making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. Does that mean we're never ever going to make a mistake? No, we probably will. But at the same time, there are a lot of things that Paul is saying here in Colossians 3, verse 12 through 17, and then picking it up here in chapter 4, that we could probably all put a little bit more work into. Trying to be more compassionate as we share the gospel with others, that we aren't so judging, you know. The idea is being salvation. The idea of being that we are trying to help others. And again, it's not just that we don't shrug the shoulders and say, well, you know, I know perfection is impossible, so can't even try. Paul says, work out your own salvation with trembling and fear. Why would he give us that command if it's not something he wants us to do? We need to work out our salvation with trembling and fear. So tonight, I know we haven't talked specifically about the gospel.